Ben Franklin said, those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Website scotthorton.org, and of course you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. Our second guest on the show today is Joe Loria. He reports on the United Nations for the Wall Street Journal, although I think we'll go ahead and disclaim that he speaks for himself when he's talking here. Thank you very much for joining us on the show again. Joe, how are you?
I'm fine, Scott. Thank you, and thank you for the disclaimer.
Yeah, I wouldn't want you to get in any trouble or anything. You do straight news for the Wall Street Journal, and it's very important stuff. First of all, can I ask you to address the targeted assassination of this Hamas leader, Jabri, in the Gaza Strip this morning?
Yeah, what's most troubling is it doesn't seem like an isolated incident. The IDF is saying this is part of a larger operation. You have to recall 4 years ago, just after the American election of 2008 and just before an Israeli election that we saw Operation Cast Lead. So there's some suspicion that with an Israeli election coming up in January and just after this election, that we could be seeing an escalation maybe on the same scale. And that would be extremely troubling, for the main reason is that the Israelis in their so-called pillar of defense, which is what they're calling the operation, think, again, that they can uproot terrorism. I think we've seen 60 years of that failed policy. Only negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians will be able to solve this issue, not another military operation by the Israelis that will lead to countless civilian deaths and probably more terrorism. We're dealing with militant thinking on both sides, and this clearly is a failure, this policy.
How many people have been killed in the most recent incursion in the past, week?
I don't have a figure on that. I think it's a couple of dozen. I don't really know, but it's not on the scale. It certainly casts lead, but it's only the beginning.
Right. Now, when you say that, you know, that it's this failed policy, this obviously failed policy of rooting out terrorism, is that really what they're doing? Is that your impression, or that's just what they say? Is it more, it seems like it's just punishment, because they know they can't root out anything. What are they going to do? Evaporate every member of Hamas right out of the Gaza Strip?
Well, if there's clear thinking on the Israeli side, they will realize that it's not going to root out terrorism. That's what they say publicly. Not really know whether some people in the Israeli establishment really believe that, if they're deluded to think that this time will end the Hamas threat once and for all. But you're right, it's certainly punishment seems to be a motive in this. And I think the election again. If you recall, they said 4 years ago, Lieberman was running against Tzipi Livni and other candidates, and you know, they wanted to show that they were tougher, and Olmert, of course, wanted to show that he was tougher than Netanyahu, and nobody's probably tougher than Netanyahu, so they launched that attack, and I think Netanyahu faced again with re-election in January, wants to show that he's protecting the Israeli people, and there have been quite a lot of rockets fired recently from Gaza into Israel, and as many as a million Israelis apparently have taken shelter, and there have been injuries, so... there has been, you could say, provocation from the Hamas side. We've pushed this whole dispute going back to 1945. Even you could go even earlier, going all the way back under the British Mandate. When did this start? This started, who fired the first shot? So, obviously, I think Netanyahu is trying to show he's tough and that he can protect the Israeli people. Just the way he's been, not to get into this subject because that's a whole other show, but just the way he's been scaring the Israeli people about Iran's nuclear program and comparing Ahmadinejad to Hitler and the Holocaust, and it's clearly a way to frighten the Israelis that these men can protect them. So I think on a smaller scale, we're seeing that in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the way, before we get back to the United Nations and Palestine's attempt to get recognition there and all that, do you know enough about Israeli politics to comment on the, I guess I'm interested in the response or the backlash or lack thereof or whatever in Israel to the merger of the Likud party with the party of the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, which I think is called Yisrael Beitenu or whatever, a right-wing nationalist secularist party that's to the right of Likud. And I guess I was hoping that it backfired and made Netanyahu look worse to the people of Israel, but I was wondering if you know.
Well, we will know in January when they vote. If they win the election, this merged party, then clearly the Israeli people are with them. If they lose, then they're not. Clearly, anybody on the left who's left in Israel, and there aren't many because it's a dwindling force in Israeli politics. It has been for some time now. Mm-hmm. They're going to be extremely alarmed by this alliance. I mean, if you could... You just said that Lieberman's party is to the right of Likud. It's pretty hard to even be to the right of Likud, but he is more extreme. And even this morning, Lieberman made a statement that Abbas should be overthrown if this vote that we're about to talk about goes ahead in the General Assembly and and Palestinians do get observer state status, non-member observer state status in the UN. So that is a more formidable right-wing force right now. Obviously, Netanyahu had to make this merger, he thought, in order to win this election. And as I said, there's no flexibility from Lieberman's party on settlements. It's a settlements party, essentially. So this will drag Netanyahu even further to the right on the settlements issue. And you might even see the hand of Lieberman now that he's been fortified by this merger and this attack, these attacks that are beginning in Gaza as well.
Mm. Well... You know, what do you make of the theory that a lot of Netanyahu's hype about Iran over the last couple of years was just to shut everybody up about the West Bank and the Gaza Strip?
Could have had that effect. I don't think that necessarily was his main motive. I don't know how he thinks about that, but it seems that he legitimately has tried to stir up extraordinary fears about annihilation and existential threats to Israel, which, as you know, have been countered by very powerful people in Israel, including Shimon Peres, president of the country, and former and current Mossad chief, and various generals who say, some of whom said explicitly, including Peres, that Iran is not an existential threat to Israel. So whether Netanyahu really believes that, or whether that's pure politics, whether it, as you suggested, it was done to distract from the Palestinian issue is speculation. But I don't think that he needs to. I don't see any flexibility on the Israeli side in terms of stopping settlements, which is the conditions that the Palestinians have given to re-enter to talks. They're not anyway keen to do that. And I think now with Lieberman's party in the government, there's even less chance, not that there was much before, of those settlements stopping and therefore of talks resuming.
All right. Now, so on this move in the United Nations to gain a higher level of status, is it full-fledged nation-state status just like everybody else that they're going after there? And then actually, before that, could you answer, is it Hamas or is it it's the Palestinian Authority, which is separate from Hamas, the old PLO? They're the ones doing this, correct?
Yes, Yes, Hamas does not agree with this move. I think it's pointless. They don't see any reason to go to the U.S. So, yes, this is purely a Palestinian Authority move. And they tried, as you remember, last September at the General Assembly. Hamas made a big speech, a huge attention and applause in the General Assembly, and he waved a piece of paper in the air saying that this was his application for full U.N. membership that he was giving to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, which he did after he left the podium. Now, for full membership of the United Nations, you need a recommendation from the Security Council to the General Assembly. So the Security Council has to approve it. And it, when they do, it's then more or less rubber-stamped in the General Assembly. The problem for the Palestinians is, of course, the United States has a veto on the Security Council. And the United States clearly threatened to veto this resolution for full membership. It also turned out that with a lot of lobbying by the U.S., it looked like the Palestinians would not even have gotten the 9 votes necessary to trigger a U.S. veto. So if it only got 8 votes, the U.S. would not have to veto because it would not have passed.
Right.
Now, at the time, Abbas said that he gave the Security Council 2 weeks to do this, and then he would go to the General Assembly to do what he's doing now. It's not clear why he never went to the General Assembly then. It is clear that in the last month or so, according to diplomats at the U.N., that he delayed this until after the elections in the United States, not to cause any problems to Obama. But if that was his motive then, he wouldn't have made that speech last September, September 2011, in the General Assembly, if you thought it was an Obama then, but he certainly delayed it now. So what we have now is a completely different situation than the Security Council, where that would be a full member state of the United Nations with all the rights of member states. That ain't going to happen. So Plan B is to go to the General Assembly and ask for non-member observer state status. This is something that the Vatican has at the UN. It's something Switzerland had for a long time until they actually became members of the UN about 10 years ago. It gives a lot of rights to the Palestinians getting this status. Number one, they can join, and most importantly, they can join various UN agencies and treaties, including the International Criminal Court, which would give them the power to go to the court and charge Israelis, even for the Castellet attacks, because any of the treaty calls for a retroactive back to 2002. Because Castellet happened 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. They can join the Law of the Sea Treaty, which would give them legal rights over their territorial waters. They could challenge the blockade in the International Court of Justice. Of course, if the International Court of Justice ruled in their favor, Israel will most likely ignore it, as they did when the ICJ ruled that the fence or the wall that separates Palestinian territories from Israeli settlements and Israel was illegal, and Israel just ignored that. But it does give them more legal rights. The International Civil Aviation Organization could be joined, which would give them, again, legal rights over their airspace. Does that mean that Israeli F-16s would stop patrolling the skies over West Bank? No, but they could challenge them legally. I think the criminal court is the one that really upsets the Israelis, because even though the ICC has not shown a propensity to go against Western governments to investigate, let's say, U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan that have killed civilians. Afghanistan is a member of the ICC. They can bring a charge against a non-member of the U.S. if a alleged crime takes place on their territory or on the territory of any ICC member. The former prosecutor of the ICC told me and a few other journalists that he was looking into that. Of course, it never happened. So these are all maybe symbolic, although they do have legal weight and gives leverage to the Palestinians in the negotiations if they ever start again with Israel, which Abbas said he would try to start the next day after this vote, which is coming on November 29th, which is a significant day because that is the 65th anniversary of the 1947 resolution passed by the General Assembly that created Israel and that partitioned the old British Mandate in Palestine, which, as you know, the Palestinians rejected at the time. But in 1988, on November 15th, which was the date they were looking at, which is tomorrow, perhaps having this vote, but they're doing it on the 29th, November 15th was the day in 1988 in which the Palestinians declared their independence. And at that moment, they accepted the partition resolution that they had rejected in 1947. And about the same day, on November 16th, 1988, 100 countries recognized Palestine as a sovereign state. Since then, 32 other countries have recognized Palestine as a sovereign state. This is very key. So many of those countries have exchanged ambassadors with Palestine. They have embassies in their capitals. Palestinians rather have embassies in their capitals. They have embassies in Ramallah. And that is a very key point, because if 132 countries say that Palestine legally is already a state, and they're basing that on the 1933 Montevideo Convention, which lays out the parameters for a territory being a legal state, that calls simply for a population living on a territory with authority to enter into relations with other governments. Palestine has all three of those. In 1915, the first Secretary General, Tigre Lee, wrote a memo saying that universal recognition was not required to be considered a state. So also there have been, let's say, Pakistan and India became states and UN members without their borders being finally defined, because Kashmir is still in dispute. So Palestine is a state, according to 132 countries. Unfortunately, among those 132 countries are not Israel and the United States. They obviously do not recognize Palestinian statehood. And therefore, we've got the political problem we've got. But for the Israelis and the Americans to say, and the American press, which trumpets and parodies this view, that Israel is not a state, I'm sorry, that Palestine is not a state, and that they want to go to the UN to become a state is false. They are, in the view of 130 countries, already a state. They're simply, we're looking for membership or now non-member status. They are a state for 132 countries. That's a very multilateral position, and if they vote on the on the 29th of November, that will be a very multilateral act. At least 97 votes are needed in the General Assembly, and they will get that, as I said, because 130 countries are already think it's a state. And Palestine will get this new status, and they will their statehood, which according to those countries 130 already exists, will be bolstered by this move.
The only argument to the contrary that I'm hearing, Joe, is, hey, this is unilateral. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to do anything unless you plan it with Netanyahu first or something like that. But I haven't heard an argument in substance as to why it is that the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip don't deserve to be independent after all these years. I mean, are they still going to claim that, well, you know, the next war could be launched from the West Bank or whatever was their excuse back in 1968 for staying?
Yes, I mean, one of the things the Israelis would want in a final status negotiation is to station Israeli troops on Palestinian territory, the state of Palestine, which Israel would recognize, inside Palestine on the border, on the river Jordan, so that arms, terrorists, whatever, could not enter from Jordan into Palestine. That's something, obviously, Palestinians do not want. They don't want foreign troops on their territory. They feel now, along with those 130 countries that recognize them, that there are already foreign troops on their territory. They see the occupation of a sovereign state by Israel. So Israel would want to keep forces on Palestinian territory. That is a huge problem, along with East Jerusalem, of course, and the return of the refugees. These are all the major issues that would have to come be settled in a negotiation. But you're right. They say it's a unilateral discussion because they are going on their own to the UN rather than coming to Israel to negotiate this issue. But as I said, this is a done deal already. There's 132 countries that already recognize Palestine. This is simply the UN passing a resolution acknowledging that and then giving them further status and legal rights inside the UN system. That's what really upsets Israelis and the Americans, is right. The legal rights that they have. But it's a supreme act of multilateral behavior to have a resolution passed in the General Assembly that should garner, you know, upwards of 130 votes, so maybe it's, you know, at least more than 100 votes they're going to get. And that's multilateralism by definition. It's not many countries coming together and expressing their views and giving legal status. So that argument doesn't wash by these countries at all, in my view.
So then, now they know that the Americans are going to go to bat for the Israelis and prevent this thing from going through, ultimately, so in a way, it's just a PR stunt or like a card to play in future negotiations. We'll drop this argument for now if you will only do this or that kind of thing. Is that right?
Well, the Americans cannot block this.
Oh, this is just in the General Assembly.
They don't have a veto in the General Assembly.
Right.
Nobody does.
Gotcha.
So this is a done deal. If they go ahead with the vote. Now, in the article I wrote in the Wall Street Journal, I pointed out in 1989, a year after the Declaration of Independence by Palestine, they went to the General Assembly for the exact same reason that they plan to do on November 29th this month, and that is to get this sort of non-member observer state status. And according to Francis Boyle, who you may or may not know, may have had on the show, I don't know, he is an American international law professor at University of Illinois in Champaign, and he is and was then an advisor to Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians, still to the Palestinians today. He was there in the General Assembly hall, and he told me, and I quote him in the Wall Street Journal article, saying that Thomas Pickering, who was the U.S. ambassador at the time, made a speech from the podium essentially saying that he would bring down the whole U.N. system if the Palestinians went ahead with this vote. And how would the U.S. do that? Well, James Baker, the Secretary of State then, and the U.S. administration now, are saying the same thing, which is that any agency that Palestinians or a Palestine state would join in the UN would be defunded. We already see this happen. UNESCO has already went ahead of the game and allowed Palestine to join as a member, as a member state last year, and the United States Congress cut off funding to UNESCO. Now, I understand the Obama administration has been trying to resume that by putting it in riders and bills and whatnot, but the Congress, you know, is not allowing that to happen. They don't want the funding of UNESCO to go on. So presumably if the ICC, the U.S. cannot do anything about it because they're not a member. But the Law of the Sea, the Nation Organization, and other agencies that they may join, WHO, whatever, could face defunding by the United States. The U.S. cannot by law not pay their U.N. dues, although we saw Ronald Reagan default them for years illegally. The United States didn't pay their dues for years under the Reagan administration. I don't think the Obama administration would want to do that, but Congress might indeed call for that if the Palestinians get this vote and become an observed state, that the U.S. should not pay its dues. So in the face of that threat, the Palestinians backed down last time in 1989. And there's a fear and there's a possibility that the Palestinians get back down again.
Oh, they blew it. They should have called James Baker's bluff right then, because defunding UNESCO is one thing. Defunding the entire General Assembly, that's suicide for the entire UN. That means that the Security Council loses all its authority, too. Right?
Right. Well, the Republican governments don't give much of a damn about the Security Council. They use it as a fig leaf. And we saw that plainly in 2003 with Bush.
Right, but they need that fig leaf, don't they?
Well, he didn't get it, and he invaded Iraq anyway in 2003.
No, that's true.
That's the Republican view. The Democrats are generally more sincere about the UN and really trying to get multilateral action. But as we've seen, administrations doing what they want, whatever the UN says. That's a very deep-seated view in conservative circles in the United States. The UN is a bunch of rubbish, and what the hell do we need it for? And we can get a resolution timed. I mean, John Bolton, at least, went on the record and actually said that. We can get the UN to go along with us. Fine. If not, we're going to do what we want anyway. We're the most powerful country in the world. Who are they? Who's going to stop us? So, you know, that could be. Now we could see maybe some compromise by the Israelis to prevent the vote. Maybe this is a card being played by the Palestinians, that they will resume talks a week before this vote, or a few days before vote, by saying that they would temporarily, cease settlements, stop settlements. But I find it hard to believe that Lieberman is emboldened in this government right now, with his party in control, part of the governing party right now. So it's going to be very interesting to see on the 29th of November, whether they go ahead with this vote. If it does, the Palestinians will win. They'll get the new status. See how the U.S. and Israel reacts to that.
Well, it's interesting what you said earlier was, I think you said that Avigdor Lieberman was saying that if the Palestinian Authority goes forward with this thing at the U.N., then they ought to overthrow Hamas.
He said that this morning. Yeah, it's from the Financial Times. I just saw that before I got on the air. I mean,
well, and what does that even mean other than occupy, you know, fully invade and occupy the Gaza Strip again? Because you can't get, what, a decapitation strike? They killed one guy this morning, but they can't just overthrow Hamas from the air.
No. They sent ground troops last time and got fled. Would it lead to that? We don't know exactly the full parameters of the Operation Defense Pillar, as they're calling this, really are.
Yeah.
But how are they going to overthrow Hamas? Are they going to occupy Ramallah? I don't think so.
Right. Well, to what degree is Abbas even independent from the Israelis? I mean, wasn't it the Americans and the Israelis that picked him in the first place?
Well, he was safe for them, I guess, to some degree, because he's clearly on board for a two-state solution. He's renounced the violence. He wants to recognize Israel as a final deal. But he has enormous pressures behind him,
right.
Not only from Palestinians and Arabs all over the region, all over the world. And he's often been seen as weak, obviously, and caves in. And again, those feelings arose when he didn't follow through on his threat last September to go to the General Assembly within 2 weeks if the Security Council didn't give him full membership. So again, he's been dawdling here, but this time, I mean, you know, if he doesn't do this on the 29th of November, maybe he won't have to be overthrown. You know, he'll lose a lot of support, obviously. Get nominated as well, but I think in order to bolster his own standing with the Palestinian people, with Arabs across the region, he needs to have this vote. Unless he really gets some kind of major concessions from the Israeli support.
Well, with or without this vote, do you see a path to, in any near term, to see the lifting of the siege of the Gaza Strip? Is there? It sort of seems like. It's just an accepted fact of life, at least, you know, in American politics that, oh, yeah, that's just how Gaza is now. It's just a prison. Oh.
No, I don't see any path. I see Israel raining some destruction on Gaza. Maybe there'll be some period of calm, and then we'll see militants once again probably firing rockets. We'll see the blockade remaining, reconstruction materials hard to get, or the food and other things like. I mean, originally the Palestinians, the Israelis were going to let potato chips into Gaza. And, the Israelis changed. I mean, this is the kind of ridiculousness of the punishment, as you pointed out, that we see in Gaza. There's just a logic there the outside world maybe can't really understand of a conflict that's gone on for these many years with leaders on both sides that are very determined to win and they're willing to use violence. Obviously, the Israelis have far more firepower to get their objectives. And I think that this vote will be very historic. It will point out if the reporters in the West are allowed to go deep into the history, which is crucial to the conflict and the argument that will happen. But there are Israeli historians who say on the left that if you look at the map of Palestine and 20, if you look at the census of the British have, it was about 80-90% Arabs living in Palestine, 10% Jews, and that continued to change until you got the situation at the time of 1947, when there was a slight, still a majority of Palestinians, but it had gone down something like 60-40, and now we're seeing that, you know, more and more territory gobbled up by Israel, but there's still a majority of the West Bank and Gaza of Arabs in former Palestine mandate. This is the reason why Israel will not annex the West Bank. Because if they did, became part of Israel, greater Israel, what do you do with all these Arabs? You can't give them a vote because they'll vote out a Jewish government and it will become an Arab-Palestinian state, presumably, hopefully, protecting minority rights of the Jews living there. But that's not going to happen. That's why Netanyahu has been going on and on about a Jewish state. So if you don't allow the Palestinians to vote, they will be a legal apartheid. Apartheid, which obviously would be very bad for Israel's image in the world. That's not going to happen either. So that's why we have the status quo of little by little gobbling up more and more territory with these settlements. And if you look at the map right now of the West Bank, it looks like somebody threw ink on the wall. These settlements are not contiguous. It's shrinking more and more of Palestinian territory. And it's a slow, creeping takeover without legal annexation.
Wow.
Although there is an Israeli right-wing party that wants to annex the settlement zone.
But now, so Joe, if I understand you right, I mean, I think what you're telling me is that the term apartheid is so politically incorrect that the fact of permanent military martial law occupation forever is actually preferable in political terms. That if they just annex the West Bank and started treating everybody in the West Bank the way they treat the Arab Israelis now, the non-Jewish Arab Israelis now, then they would be officially an apartheid state, and that would be worse PR-wise than what they do every day as they have for 40 years now.
That's correct. Because what they do now is they can justify that there's still terrorism and they need to have an occupation there to protect the settlements, but more importantly to keep Palestinians from coming from the West Bank into Israel proper to commit acts of terror. And, of course, these rockets from Gaza gives them the justification they feel to go on with military actions against the Gaza Strip, as we've seen happening now. So, yes, right. It would be worse for them, no question. A lot of American Jews would not be able to support that.
Even though, of course, it's apartheid right now. The people of the West Bank are Israelis. They're just occupied helots with, you know, fourth-class citizen status or something. But they sure are subjects of the Israeli government, aren't they?
Yeah, but it's not a legal apartheid in the sense of them not having the right to vote, even if they are, or citizenship, they're living in the country.
Right.
That would be, see, that's the thing they want to avoid, and they have avoided.
The first time that I really got my attention drawn to this subject, because it always just seemed too complicated to me. Someone will, you know, I'll figure it out someday or something, but I'm putting it off. But it was in 1998 or something, I think, that Hillary Clinton, the first lady, in no official position, said that, well, of course, everybody agrees that someday there will be a Palestinian state. And the entire media went, oh, my God, Hillary Clinton uttered the term Palestinian state. Did she have authorization to say that? What does that mean? This is the biggest deal in the world. You're not supposed to say Palestinian state. Not for another dozen years or something. And I remember thinking, wow, that sure seems a pretty heavy-handed response to the uttering of a term. Well, what the hell, you know? That was kind of what got me interested in this topic in the first place, was, and Hillary Clinton, of course, is the model of centrism and establishmentarianism. She sure didn't mean to get out of line. She wasn't trying to be controversial and stir up trouble. It was an accident, a faux pas.
Yeah, but look where we've come from now. We've had Netanyahu utter those words, and George Bush did it before that. So she was ahead of the head of her game there, but and also there were 100 countries that already had recognized the Palestinian state, so it was in existence. She was talking about Israel and the U.S. recognizing a Palestinian state,
course,
joining that. And that's still the aim. That's what Netanyahu says he still wants. But little by little, more and more of the West Bank is gobbled up by these settlements, a continuation of the really the policy of driving Palestinians off their land. I mean, many of them did run away because they were afraid that the Israeli army would attack the villages. Many others were told by Arab general at the time, or Arab army that was joining the fight in 47 to leave the country, and we'll defeat Israel, then come back, because they didn't, and they're not coming back. But, you know, there's an unfortunate saying that a lot of Israelis believe that this Israel was a country for a country without a people for a people without a country, and that's not true. Many, many Palestinians living in Israel whose villages are gone and who have never will ever probably ever be able to come back again. And even if Israel recognizes a Palestinian state at some point, they won't allow Palestinians to come back and live there. Not in huge numbers anyway. So there's no path to any solution to this situation. The status quo serves Israel, this low-intensity war in which, you know, there have been many fewer deaths from Palestinian terrorism in Israel. One has to say that that fence, that barrier that they built, that the ICJ said was illegal, probably has had an effect on preventing Palestinians from entering. But the suffering of the vast majority of the Palestinian people who are not terrorists, you know, is a huge price for those people to pay. But there has been a reduction in terrorism, but there's been an increase in the settlements. So I think the status quo is good for Netanyahu, good for Israel, they have U.S. backing. But this vote really was just poking the eye to Israel and the U.S., because the U.N. will be saying, look, you know, there's 130 of us here at least that have been saying for years that Palestine's a state. And we're going to say it openly in the U.N. now, and we're going to let them join all these organizations and treaties like they're a state. The only thing is they can't introduce resolutions. They can't vote in the General Assembly. I mean, but, you know, so there are going to be restrictions on what Palestinians can do with the U.N., but it is a major upgrade. The Palestinians and their supporters feels high time that they did this and put pressure on Israelis. And this is going to be an enormously interesting and historic moment in this long conflict on November 29th.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be keeping our eyes on the Wall Street Journal. And I hope when this does happen, maybe a few days after when we know the first kind of responses to it, then maybe we can have you back to talk about what's going on.
Yeah, as you just to end, the Israelis say they will not give tax revenues that they collect for Palestine. That's $100 million a month, and the U.S. is threatening to cut off $500 million in aid.
Well, that's how they got Hamas elected in the first place, was cutting off all the tax revenues to Yasser Arafat so he couldn't buy up all the votes he needed.
They did that for a while, and then the pressure came on Israel, and they released the taxes. So they haven't done this before yet, and they're threatening to do it again. And the Palestinians have to find money from the Gulf, from Europe, who knows, the Chinese, I mean somebody, they're going to have to find this money.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time on the show and all your great reporting, Joe. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Scott. Good to talk to you. All the best.
Yep, you too. All right, everybody, that is UN Joe. Joe Loria from the Wall Street Journal. Hey, folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount.